This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you look back in history, whenever we didn't understand a disease or an illness, our response to people who got sick was always the same. We blamed the person with the illness. There was a time when people who had cancer were stigmatized. No one would dare say the C word out loud. The same was true, and still is to a certain extent, for mental illness such as depression. But through the ages, as we became more enlightened about disease and disease processes, we have come to understand that cancer or mental illness is not a moral failure or a character weakness, but a disease. The same can be said about our attitudes toward addiction. Only now are we beginning to understand that addiction is a disease, that there are real biophysical changes that occur in the brain that can make some people vulnerable to becoming addicted and make it nearly impossible for them to quit. Time after time, they relapse. This hour, we're going to be talking about what scientists are learning about addiction and how that knowledge is changing the way addicts are perceived and treated. And if you'd like to get in on our conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. But I need to remind you, as we always do, that we really cannot diagnose or treat your problem, addiction, or what is bothering you over the air. But we'll be happy to talk about it in a general sense. It's just not ethical to ask our doctors to sort of talk about your problems, so please don't do that. Let me introduce my guests. Nora Volkoff is the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome. Shelley Greenfield is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and Associate Clinical Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. She joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Rob Malenka is the Pritzker Professor in Psychiatry and Behavior Sciences at Stanford University. Dr. Malenka joins us by phone from the campus. Thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Volko. Dr. Volko, is there any question that addiction is a disease now?
There is no question that addiction is a disease. Research has shown that it affects the brain in very specific ways that can help us understand why, through this damage, the person loses control of his or her action as it relates to taking drugs. So it is recognized that it is a disease. Despite this, it is still not accepted as a disease by most people.
You mean even doctors, physicians themselves?
Unfortunately, yes. While they, in some instances, may say, yes, it's a disease, and then they immediately put, but. And the moment that you hear the but, that right. You start to recognize all of the reasons why they start to counter that argument. So, yes, indeed, even physicians do not recognize it sometimes as a disease.
Dr. Greenfield, you work in a clinic, you see people with addiction. Where does something cross the line from being a habit, a bad habit, to something that's being addicted?
That's a good question, Ira. I think where it crosses the line is where we think of addiction as a compulsive use of a substance or a compulsive behavior that continues to take place in the life of someone in spite of the negative consequences that that person actually acquires because of their use of the substance. And this actually is quite different from a habit that might be somewhat annoying to the person or annoying to somebody else, but doesn't start to manifest itself in a number of negative consequences in that person's life.
Mm-hmm. So that the addiction becomes the overwhelming part of that person's life?
Sure. We have a number of things that we look for in terms of when we begin to call something an addiction. We're really looking for adverse consequences in a person's life, such as a person spending more time using a substance or using it in greater quantities than they want to, giving up activities because they're using the substance or recovering from it, that they continue to use something in spite of the fact that they know it jeopardizes their physical or their mental health. So those are ways that we can distinguish between something that's what we might call a habit and something that actually has begun to be the disease we know as addiction.
Dr. Malenk, let's get right down to the physiology of addiction. I know that's what you study and you specialize in. What happens in your brain when you take drugs or alcohol for the first time and then something happens that makes you addicted to it?
Well, that's a very good question, but a complicated and difficult one to answer. I think, and again, Dr. Volkoff also knows a lot about this topic, and she can hopefully pipe in. I think one of the breakthroughs in the addiction field was the realization that one common action of many different substances of abuse, whether it's nicotine or alcohol or cocaine or heroin, that they all work on something we call the brain's reward circuitry. You know, through evolution, the brain has evolved to tell us what feels really good, what is rewarding, what is important for our survival. And we now know that all these different drugs of abuse act on this specific circuit in these specific brain areas. We also know that an important chemical messenger in these brain circuits is a substance we call dopamine. It's a substance we term a neurotransmitter. And it turns out that all these different addictive substances increase the actions or the release of dopamine. And then in very complex ways that we're beginning to understand, but we have a long way to go, the release of this dopamine in certain brain structures tells the person that this substance is reinforcing or rewarding. And then for certain genetically vulnerable individuals, there are adaptations, long-lasting changes in these circuits that lead the person to believe that the pursuit of this substance is the most important thing in their life. And I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but there are changes, long-lasting changes in the connections between nerve cells as a consequence of the use of the drug. These connections we term synapses. So the communication between individual nerve cells that are part of this circuit start to change. There are molecular changes in these cells that are part of these circuits, and we know we're beginning to learn a reasonable amount about what are these molecular changes, what are these changes in specific connections between nerve cells, and that's the first step towards trying to understand how to reverse those changes.
So, Dr. Volkoff, we're actually rewiring the brain during addiction?
Correct. The brain learns by the experience, the experience produced by drugs, which is one, not only that is experienced as highly reinforcing, pleasurable, but also highly salient. And one of the aspects that we've come to recognize is not just that drugs can activate these reward centers by increasing the concentration of dopamine, but they do it in much more powerful and long-lasting ways than any of the natural reinforcers. So as a result of that, it is believed that the brain tries to adapt to this very strong stimulation by drugs to compensate, and it is believed that these adaptations are the ones that lead to the changes that that occur in addiction. One of the things about these reward centers is exactly the way that nature ensures that we will do behaviors that are indispensable for survival. Ensures. So one of the mechanisms is not just that you feel pleasure, but in parallel to this experience, the areas of the brain in which you encode memories, and it's not just the memory of the event, but the emotional memory, get activated by that experience in such a way that the next time that you get exposed to the drug or to stimuli associated with the drug, it will recreate a sensation leading to the intense desire to procure the drug. So it's not just the issue of experiencing pleasure, but the consequences in the memory that is associated, as you asked the question, with plastic changes, with the formation of new synapses that will then drive the behavior.
So then any kind of memory of what started you, I'm getting to the idea about relapsing. Even if you've kicked the habit or the addiction the first time, it's very easy to relapse should that little stimulus happen again.
It's extraordinarily important what you are bringing up in the terms of why it's so difficult to treat addiction and why people, despite the fact that they face catastrophic consequences, not negative, catastrophic, and they don't want to take the drug anymore, they relapse. And it has to do, it's almost like a reflex. It's almost when you think about something you like and you start to salivate, inside your brain there is a release of dopamine when the person that's addicted sees stimuli associated with the drug that activate the motivational circuit almost in a reflex-like way. And that drives him or her to do that behavior. And that's evidently one of the mechanisms by way why it's relapse occurs and it's so difficult to kick up the habit.
So finding a way to erase that original circuitry then was a challenge.
I mean, and indeed, that's one of the strategies that we're now trying to encourage investigators to look at the development of medications that can either erase those memories associated with the drug, or alternatively, very important, can you create stronger memories that can overcome those learned responses so that your behavior is not driven by what we call conditioning, but by these new learned experiences. And there is ongoing research. It's at these stages, it's predominantly done in laboratory animals, but there are some really interesting positive results that suggest that this strategy may, in fact, prove beneficial in helping through the therapeutic process.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more about addiction with my guests, Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health, Shelley Greenfield, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, Associate Clinical Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, Rob Malenka, Pritzker Professor in Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. When we come back, we're also going to bring on someone who has a firsthand experience with drug addiction, Marvin Seppala, who is Chief Medical Officer for the Hazelden Foundation. If you know anything about drug addiction, you know what the Hazelden Foundation is in Minnesota. He's going to join us. Hope you will stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about drug addiction this hour with Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Shelley Greenfield of Harvard Med School, Rob Malenka of Stanford. I also want to bring on now Marvin Seppala, who is chief medical officer for the Hazelden Foundation. He joins us by phone from Oregon. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Seppala.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ira.
I understand that originally you planned to be a surgeon. What happened?
Well, originally, I had no vocational plans and actually dropped out of high school as a result of addiction, and later was hired into a research lab at the Mayo Clinic before I went to college. I applied to be a janitor, and I can't explain how I got this job, but somehow was hired as a laboratory technician. And in that lab, I managed to get clean and sober, attending self-help meetings. I had already been through treatment at 17 after dropping out of high school, but at this point at 19 got clean and sober and was influenced by the physicians. They were fellows from all over the world doing fellowships at the Mayo Clinic, and ultimately decided I'd be a doctor and a surgeon like some of them. And halfway through medical school, I saw how few doctors understood addiction and fewer cared about it. And I was complaining about this to friends, and they said, Marv, you got to quit complaining and do something about this. And it was at that point I chose to go into the field of addiction.
Mm-hmm. Are most of the people you treat at Hazelden seeking treatment for the first time, or are they relapsing?
Yeah, the bulk of them are seeking treatment after prior treatment, so relapsing. But most of our programs are residential programs, and that would usually be the case, that often people have failed other levels of care first.
Mm-hmm. Shelley Greenfield, you find that to be true too?
Do I find it to be true that people are seeking care multiple times? I would say yes. In most circumstances, people do seek care multiple times, and a lot of this is because of the kinds of neurobiological changes that Dr. Volkoff and Dr. Malenka have talked about. One thing that's very helpful in understanding the neurobiology of the brain is it can help explain to patients and their doctors why moving past and getting well and into recovery can be so difficult. On the other hand, the other part that's so important for people to understand is, like other types of medical disorders, addiction is a treatable disorder and people do actually get better. But like other medical disorders like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, people generally don't get better on a single treatment. They often require several different treatments, sometimes different types of treatments, over time in order to slowly but surely regain their health, their physical health, and their mental health.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Jennifer in Boston. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
My question actually was, I'm listening to your program, and I understand what you're saying when there's a substance involved, like how you how you can be medically addicted to, say, nicotine or alcohol. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about people's brains when they're addicted to a behavior like gambling. Do you see the same changes? And, do you actually consider it the same type of addiction?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Dr. Malenka first, and then I'll get to Dr. Volkoff.
I think, and again, Dr. Volkoff can comment on this, I think the general consensus is, yes, that a lot of these other kinds of compulsive, especially rewarding behaviors, reinforcing behaviors like gambling, like overeating, like perhaps even video game playing, certainly affect these so-called reinforcement or reward circuits, do affect the release of this chemical messenger dopamine. A little bit of the issue, the devil's in the details. There's been some elegant work in part done by Dr. Volkoff showing that it's not only the release of this chemical messenger dopamine, but it's how much is released and how fast it's released. And that has an important influence on the effect of that ingestion of a substance or that behavior has on your brain. And it turns out the highly addicting substances like cocaine and heroin, and again, I'm actually talking about in part Dr. Volkoff's work, really cause a much more rapid, stronger increase in this chemical messenger than, for instance, what I do all the time, which is eat donuts or eat a quart of Haagen-Dazs ice cream, which is highly rewarding for me, but I can kick the habit when I choose to.
You've given it up 100 times.
Absolutely.
Dr. Volkoff, please.
A very interesting question that has started to intrigue many of the scientists. Certainly it has intrigued me for many years. And using imaging, me and my colleagues at Brookhaven National Laboratory have actually delineated some of the changes in the brain that are similar, specifically in pathological eating in obesity versus those that we see in addiction, but at the same time identify the differences. So yes, there are similarities, but there are also differences. Where we find the similarities is in both conditions, in this case overeating versus addiction, there is a marked disruption of the function of the brain dopamine system, which is, the one that's directly affected by drugs, but it's also the one that motivates our behavior vis-a-vis natural activities like eating or doing social interactions or engaging in procreation, sexual behaviors. So that system becomes dysfunctional, is dysfunctional in both of these conditions. And it is believed that one of the reasons why there is a motivation to either continue taking the drug or to compulsively eat is that it's a mechanism to compensate for this deficit. On the other hand, what's uniquely different, for example, in this case of pathologically obese individuals, is that their brain is particularly sensitive to the pleasurable aspects associated with food. And it is believed that evidently that is the reason why they are favoring this particular stimuli, in this case food, over other ones. So this is why some people become addicted specifically to a certain substance and others may become addicted to behavior, because each one of our brains responds with a different sensitivity to the rewarding effects of the stimuli.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jennifer?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. If you hooked somebody up to one of these brain scanners, could you see in real time, and if you looked at the brain of someone who was craving a substance, see the changes that are going on in there?
Yes, indeed. And multiple investigators have been trying to see which areas of the brain get associated, get activated when you are craving. And it took us by surprise, because what the first study started to show many years ago was it was not the limbic areas of the brain that we usually expected, but actually the famous frontal cortex, which is the area of the brain that does cognitive operations that allows us to exert judgment. But there's an area in the frontal cortex, just on top of your eyes, that is directly connected to the limbic brain, that is involved with assigning value to stimuli. So a stimuli may be very exciting on a given moment of our lives, but not in another one. And that's the area of the brain that gets activated when a person is craving. In parallel, also, we see activation of some of the limbic areas of the brain. So, yes, indeed, you can see your brain when it's craving.
1-800-989-8255. Bob, why does stress often cause people to relapse? And we are always under stress now. Do you have any idea?
Was that question directed to me, Ira?
Yeah, I'll ask you first, and I'll ask Dr. Volkoff.
Well, it turns out that the circuits in the brain that respond to stress, that release certain hormones in response to stress that tell us that we're under stress, are heavily interconnected with the exact circuits we've been talking about, these so-called reward circuits, these circuits that use dopamine, and work from many labs has shown that both in humans as well as in animal models of addiction, that stress is a very important factor in leading to relapse and causing the continued use of a substance, as well as leading to relapse. And it turns out that, at least in certain instances, the brain's response to stress is actually pretty similar in under certain cases to the brain's response to certain drugs of abuse. So a classic set of experiments has shown that if you train an animal to self-administer a drug, or again, this happens in human beings too, and then you take the drug away for many weeks or months, that an acute stressful event can have that person or animal start using the drug again. We believe that's because that stress, as I said, is causing somewhat the same, perhaps the same release of dopamine even that the substance of abuse causes.
Dr. Volkoff, you want to amplify?
Yes, indeed. It's evident, as Dr. Malenka was commenting, that there is overlap in the circuits and brain areas affected by drugs and affected by stress. And where does that come together? It comes together, again, interestingly, in dopamine. Dopamine is not only there to signal pleasure, but actually to signal saliency. And as you recognize, of course, pleasurable events are very salient. We need to learn from there. But a stress is also very salient, because if we do not learn from it, when we are exposed to it again, we may not avoid it. So anything that has importance in terms of the survival of the species that connotes a need to learn an experience so you can change your behavior accordingly will involve dopamine. So yes, when you are exposed to a stress, you're going to be releasing dopamine. And that's going to, again, drive a similar circuitry to that we see in drug addiction. And in individuals that are addicted, the increase in dopamine by itself is a conditioned response. It's a learned memory response that associates with the drug. And this is probably one of the reasons why when a person that's going through recovery, it's stress, and then they relapse in a way similar to the way they relapse when they get exposed to a stimuli that in the past they had associated with the use of drugs.
Dr. Greenfield, are doctors and nurses adequately trained to spot signs of substance abuse, even when they come into an emergency room for what appears to be something else?
Ira, that's a very important point. And actually, I think that, in fact, oftentimes, doctors and nurses, in spite of their best efforts and desires to be helpful to patients, are not always trained as well as they might be to think about drugs and alcohol in a variety of clinical settings. In fact, as you know, drug and alcohol addiction are among the largest, most prevalent problems that we have. They present a major public health problem in addition to an individual and family problem. And in fact, in almost every healthcare setting, whether it's a physical healthcare setting or a mental healthcare setting, patients present themselves for other types of disorders, and they also have a co-occurring substance use disorder. And this, in fact, will present an opportunity for physicians and nurses to actually engage patients and screen them for whether they're using alcohol or drugs in a harmful way or whether they already perhaps have become addicted or dependent on these substances. Sometimes it's helpful and a doctor can actually catch a patient where something is just teeter-tottering on moving forward into becoming a major abuse or dependence problem and can help by educating a patient and referring them to treatment to intervening earlier on in the course of a disease process. And of course, in every area of medicine, what we try to do is intervene as early as possible. But often doctors and nurses haven't had adequate clinical training to screen and diagnose and to understand what the treatment processes are.
That raises all kinds of issues I want to get to, but I want to first remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Because one of the issues I want to get to is many times you see in Hollywood or the Hollywood version of what happens in an emergency room or in a hospital is the same addicts show up, they get shoved into a corner, the nurses or the physicians say, oh, it's just so-and-so showing up again to dry out, and they never get that attention that they need. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Are you addressing that to me?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think in some circumstances it can be. You know, one of the things that I think is very important to understand is that the person who may come back time and time again into an emergency room, there are individuals like that who do require help, who aren't necessarily referred on. But, you know, they represent also a very tip of the iceberg phenomenon. And in fact, the vast majority of folks who have substance use disorder problems many are working every day. They are taking care of various kinds of responsibilities out in the world, and they are actually having problems with addiction. Sometimes those things manifest themselves at home rather than at work. Sometimes they may not show up in an emergency room, but they may show up maybe in a mental health care clinic or a physical health care clinic. So I think this is not just, you know, in the emergency room with someone who's coming in acutely multiple times, but it's a much more generalizable to all sorts of healthcare settings where we as medical professionals can do a much, much, much better job at diagnosing early and referring for treatment many, many individuals who could actually benefit from all the available treatments that do exist and are actually effective.
Marvin Tepley, you agree?
I do agree. And in fact, although the training for physicians and nurses is limited in regard to addiction, it has improved somewhat. There's a new emphasis. And even now, level one trauma centers, as one of their requirements to reach that designation, have to evaluate addiction and alcohol dependence in the population that comes into their emergency room settings. And that's the highest level of an emergency room that's designated.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about addiction this hour. Before we go to the break, Dr. Volkoff, is this something that your institute worries about a lot?
Yes, I worry a lot about it. And in fact, I was smiling because that question, when I had to cover the emergency room as a psychiatrist, was a very frustrating one when we would get the patients and we really didn't know what to do with them. So yes, it is frustrating. And I think that it's still ongoing. The sense that a patient that is addicted when they have a job or they are referred by their physician is very different from the situation of a person that is homeless, that doesn't have a job, that doesn't have a family, that ends up in the emergency room and you are actually hand-tied in terms of what you can offer. So yes, we are particularly interested on the issue from the National Institute on Drug Abuse about how to increase the education of the medical community vis-a-vis the early recognition and the evaluation and proper referral of a person that is addicted. Unfortunately, many physicians do not ask the question. Why don't they ask the question? Because drug addiction is stigmatized and they feel uncomfortable asking the patients, do they drink? Do they take cocaine? And they don't even know how to ask that question sometimes, and certainly not recognize it. There's another element to it. Even if they do know how to ask the question, they don't necessarily know what to do with that particular person, where to refer them to, how to follow them up. And there's another element that is very, very relevant. Unfortunately, there is no parity for the treatment of drug addiction. So as a result of that, many medical insurances will not cover the cost of doing an evaluation for drug addiction and proper referral.
All right, Dr. Volkoff, hang on there. Everybody else, hang on with us. We have to take a short break, pay some bills. We'll be right back after this, so stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about addiction with my guests, Dr. Nora Volkoff, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Dr. Shelley Greenfield, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School, Dr. Rob Malenka, Pritzker Professor in Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. Dr. Marvin Sapala is Chief Medical Officer for the Hazelden Foundation. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a few phone calls in. Mark in Boston. Hi, Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark. Great show. I love you so much. So I have an interesting story, a comment that goes along with the question. My father was actually the head of a halfway house, which was for many years was helping like hundreds of people with drug and alcohol addiction, many successfully. And so he was an example to this community, and for over 20 years was completely sober. And then suddenly he relapsed, and he's been completely gone, and, you know, me and other members of my family have had a funeral for him, pretty much, because he's still alive, but he's not the person we once knew, and there's really no hope of getting him back. So that's the story. It's just we've seen personally how addictive tendencies can totally rewire someone's priorities and irrevocably change who they are. I was wondering, is there any evidence that the later one gets in life, the more fixed patterns you get, the more less plastic their brain gets, the more irrevocable they are. Is there any kind of pattern of addiction recovery being easier earlier on in life or becoming more intractable later on in life?
Let me ask Marvin Sepala first that question.
I think it's certainly more difficult to address addiction in an older population. And I think your description in regard to questions of plasticity and in the brain are fairly accurate, that plasticity does decrease with age. I think the researchers should address that aspect of it, but we've done a great deal of work with the older population and find that we have to address their addiction slower, allowing more time, and in a way that, I mean, you're a little bit different than most of the people we see, because family members often deny that there's a problem in an older person, and most often, you know, it's kind of like you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and that's not necessarily true, because we see good outcomes in an elderly population.
Well, that's good to hear, but I think what's one of the worst things about this situation is that with some people with their habits, they become actually positively dangerous, and you can't really rely on the their affections for family or their morals or any of those other things to protect you in those situations. So the family often has an unfortunate choice where they have to cut off all contact for their own safety, and also material and also mental safety. So I appreciate the work that you're doing, and this is a great program.
Thanks for calling. Good luck to you. 1-800-989-8255. Shelley Greenfield, is that a common case
that
you hear?
I was listening to the caller's story, and obviously I think one of the things that he points out is that addiction is an individual problem, but it's also one that affects families and affects communities. And I think he's talking about a situation that, you know, I wouldn't say is so very common. I think, in fact, overall, people do relapse, but in fact there are many, many available treatments that are quite effective, and across the entire population range, from the very young, early adolescents, all the way through actually the very old. And I do think there's a lot of variability amongst individuals in terms of their own inherent vulnerabilities to the substance, in terms of how long and severe their use was, how much abstinence they had, and also what other kinds of co-occurring disorders they might be battling, such as depression or anxiety or an eating disorder. Many individuals with substance use disorders are also battling other types of mental health problems as well. And so there's a lot of individual variation. I think, in fact, though, that we are able to treat a vast majority of folks and actually, in many instances, have people who are in recovery for many years, sometimes with relapses that occur periodically. Hopefully, if they remain connected to treatment and to a treatment community, they can recognize a relapse quickly and associate themselves again with treatment that's been helpful and shorten the actual duration of their actual relapse or lapse. And that's what we aim for, to keep people as healthy as we can over time. And if they do slip or relapse, to shorten the duration of that and to return them as quickly as possible to their best functioning selves.
Dr. Volkoff, are there any drugs or potential drugs that are on the horizon or might be developed, that are waiting to be developed, that might not just treat the addiction but reverse those brain wiring pathways?
Very challenging question indeed, and we are trying again encourage investigators using laboratory animals to do exactly that. Can you strengthen certain pathways that have been damaged by the chronic use of drugs? There are some very interesting compounds that, for example, are targeting more the disruptions that exist in the memory circuit. We're also looking to strengthening the ability of your brain to through cognitive operations to regulate your emotions and your desires. And this is, of course, a pathway that is badly eroded by the uses of drugs. Those compounds are currently being investigated in animal studies, some with actually fascinating positive results. But it's very difficult to get these compounds into the clinic because, first of all, it's very, very expensive. And in general, the major burden of developing these medications has relied on the pharmaceutical industry. And here, the pharmaceutical industry is not one of their primary interests. And there are many reasons why that is so, but one of them is that drug addiction is stigmatized. There's, as we were mentioning before, there's not even parity for drug addiction. So that does not help, certainly doesn't help the translation of potentially promising medications into the practice.
But let me just stop you. But there are potentially so many people who could be helped by this. You always hear drug companies saying, well, there's not a big enough market for a drug that we might produce. It seemed like there would be a big enough market here for them.
Yes, indeed, and particularly because what we started to recognize is that there may be medications. If you're developing a medication, you don't necessarily need to address it a medication for cocaine addiction, but rather a medication for addiction in general. And then you can start to recognize that, indeed, the market could be very large. The other aspect about it, as we were discussing before, is because some of these processes also underline some of the behavioral compulsive disorders, such as pathological gambling or compulsive eating. These medications could also be beneficial in addressing some of the disruption that we see in these individuals. So, yes, I agree that there is a market. But as I said, unfortunately, stigmatization has not helped. And there's always the sense and fear. And I can understand the pharmaceutical way they come from, because they have to make a profit, of course, is the sense that a person will be reluctant to take a medication that is useful for depression, because it also seems to be a medication that is being used, for example, for the treatment of heroin addiction. So there's always fear about that. How can that affect the perception of a given medication? And that has influenced the pharmaceutical.
And so you haven't been able to talk them into working on it.
Indeed. I would say that is changing. I think that the pharmaceutical industry has been much more open over the past 5 years to start that dialogue and explore the feasibility, I think, in terms of not just from the perspective of carers who are going to make a profit, but they recognize the importance that this would have to the community. The ability to be able to develop, for example, a medication through methamphetamine addiction would be quite extraordinary.
And Ira, if I can add in, another reason the pharmaceutical industry is beginning to pay attention is our understanding of the neurobiological basis of addiction has advanced enormously, in large part because of the efforts of NIDA over the last 10 or 20 years. So they're beginning to realize, you know, this is a biological problem that can be attacked with modern biomedical research efforts, and that there's really some hope. You know, 20 or 30 or whatever it was, 40 years ago, and we had really very limited understanding, there was no way to rationally develop pharmacotherapies for various addictions. And now that there's been such great progress, you can start thinking of many different approaches to take.
Go ahead. Somebody wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I was going to jump in. I would also echo that this stigmatization has really held back the general public understanding of all the gains that have been made over the last 20 years, both in the basic biology, but also we have 20 plus years of treatment-related research on many different models of treatment, both behavioral and pharmacotherapeutic, singly and in combinations, that have been demonstrated in multi-site trials funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and other federal agencies that have demonstrated time and time again that this treatment actually works. People actually get better. People do much better. And so our public ideas, whether it's the public in general or the public in terms of medical professionals, patients, families, are behind the times, very much so, in catching up with this vast amount of research that has been done over the last 20 years that really shows this over and over again from the basic biology. It's a classic bench-to-bedside story, basic biology and treatment-related research demonstrating over and over again that many, many patients can be helped.
So, Dr. Volkoff, we have these drugs. They've been tried out. We just can't get them to market.
We cannot, we cannot get them into the clinics. We cannot get the translation from the animal experiments into the humans as fast as we could because of restriction in budgets. The government has to carry the costs associated with this medication development. But I do want to make a point that Dr. Greenberg was covering because I think it's very important. There are many treatments, not just medications, but there's actually behavioral cognitive group therapies that have been unequivocally shown that they work, they are effective in the treatment of drug addiction, and yet they are not necessarily all the time accepted as such. And what we've come to recognize actually very much through the insight of Dr. McLellan is one of the reasons has been that people expect the person that goes to treatment to be miraculously cured over going to a rehabilitation program. So they go through that rehabilitation program, they stop taking the drugs. 6 months later, something happens in their life and they relapse. And that is then used as an argument. You see, treatment does not work. Of course, we would never use that argument for someone that is being treated with an antihypertensive medication for high blood pressure. The moment he or she stops taking the medicine and blood pressure goes up, you'll never use the arguments. You see, that does not work. So we've been treating the problem of drug addiction again, and this relates to the whole stigmatization aspect of it, very differently from the way that we treat other diseases. And the same thing in terms of what we expect of the treatment of drug addiction. We expect a cure, yet we know that it's a chronic disease. So we are treating. Very rarely do we cure right now.
Mm-hmm. Talking about drug addiction this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did someone want to jump in there?
Yeah,
Dr. Greenfield, was that you? Yes,
that was me. I want to just follow up on what Dr. Volkoff just said because it's so important. Actually, if you follow along that model and continue to think about it, for someone who's being treated for diabetes or heart disease or hypertension, what you hope you would do is you would help them in the acute first illness that they had, and then you enter them into treatment and you want them to be followed up over the long term to keep them healthy and hopefully to prevent any more acute episodes. This is very similar to substance abuse treatment. People come in acutely, you treat them, and then what you'd really like to do is enter them into care where they're followed to keep them as healthy as possible. If people are connected to care, if there is a stressful life event or something else that comes up, they're already hooked into care and they can usually continue how they're doing or circumvent any exacerbation in their condition, hopefully avoiding, if possible, another major episode. And this is truly a model of keeping people well over time, that it's it's really important we begin to implement for people with substance use disorders. We have many models in chronic disease care that work. We know this is a kind of model that will work for substance abuse as well over the long term.
Dr. Mileka, I'm going to give you my famous blank check question, which is if you had a blank check and you could spend it anywhere and you needed a breakthrough or some medical equipment or some sort of laboratory experiment that you would like to perform, what would it be so you could learn more about this?
Oh, wow. Are you really going to give me that?
Well, a hypothetical. The same check I give everybody.
I think I would just actually I would do a little bit, a lot more of what NIDA and other agencies are currently doing. I would put more money into really defining both the molecular changes in the brain that happen in response to substances of abuse or during addiction, but really beef up the imaging approaches so we can really understand, because the devil is always in the details, which specific brain areas, which specific connections, which circuits in the brain are really being modified in a semi-permanent way during addiction. I would also probably put a lot of the money, if I had a blank check, into trying to identify, either both genetically and through other approaches, those people are going to be most vulnerable to developing addiction. Trying to get kids, you know, I think, and again, Dr. Volkoffs and Greenfield can speak at a more sophisticated level about this, but I believe people really start developing their problems mostly during adolescence, late adolescence, early adulthood. And I think it would be wonderful if we could identify those specific individuals that are going to be particularly susceptible and vulnerable.
Let me give someone who handles money, Dr. Volkoff, the last 30 seconds to tell us what she would do with the money if she had it.
Well, I'd like to be able with the money to create the knowledge that will allow us to have parity for substance abuse, the knowledge that will drive and motivate and incentivize the pharmaceutical industry to be able to fund medications into clinical practice, and finally, to use that knowledge to create more targeted prevention such that less people get exposed to drugs.
Dr. Mileka was saying, identify kids at a younger age who might be susceptible.
The earlier we start, the better off we are, because if we can indeed intervene early, we may be able to cure addiction.
Thank you very much all for joining me. Dr. Nora Volkoff, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Shelley Greenfield, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School and Associate Clinical Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Mass. Dr. Robert Mileka-Pritzker, Professor in Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, and Dr. Marvin Seppala, Chief Medical Officer for the Hazelden Foundation in Minnesota. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for covering this topic.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and Charles Berquist in New York. Our intern is Judy Leibach. Megan Moline and Becky Vlamis work the phones for us today. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us an email there. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Free teaching materials we make for you to take to your classrooms. Also, podcasting. If you missed today's program, you want to download it on your iPod or your laptop. Take it with you. It'll be up there just a little bit as Charles gets it ready after the program. Also, back editions of Science Friday are all there. And we're blogging now, so you can tell us whatever you think about the topics we put up there for our blog. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.